From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco for Terry Gross, who is on vacation this week. On this edition of Fresh Air, theologian Harvey Cox. For him, ancient religions are very much part of our present. Cox examines how old-time religions and the modern world intersect and sometimes collide. We'll learn from Harvey Cox what's new in the secular city. Also today, we talk with Eva Hoffman. She's just written a memoir of her early life in post-war Poland, her emigration to Canada, and her sometimes traumatic adjustment to life in this country. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recent recordings from the Cleveland Orchestra, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the origins of the nickname Hoosiers. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. My guest today is theologian Harvey Cox. He's a professor at the Harvard Divinity School and the author of eight books, including The Secular City, now widely reprinted and translated. His new book, Many Mansions, tells of his experiences establishing dialogues with people of many different faiths and the influences of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and Judaism on his own theological ideas. Harvey Cox's curiosity about other religions is part of a personal faith journey that became widely known with the publication of The Secular City in 1965. Almost 25 years ago, when The Secular City was published, Cox saw that increasing urban civilization and consumerism were linked to the collapse of traditional religion. But there's been a lot of change since then. The rise of fundamentalist religions, the increase of political power amongst religious groups, and the growing holistic back-to-the-earth movements. I wondered what provoked the changes since he wrote The Secular City.
Well, certainly many of the predictions that were made back there 20 to 25 years ago about the future of religion turned out to be mistaken. Most observers were forecasting that religion in one way or another would become more marginal or more peripheral to the modern urban world. It would certainly continue as a personal dimension of life, but I think what was not foreseen was this rather remarkable resurgence of religion in the public sphere, in political life and things of that nature. I think one of the things that's happened, perhaps the single most important thing that's brought this about, is a certain kind of disappearance of the bloom from the rose of the promise of science and technology and progress and all of that. Already, even 25 years ago, there were some seeds of doubt, but in the last 25 years, that I think we just have to say that the promise of scientific technology appears to have been oversold. And now we are living with some of the fallout, literally and symbolically, of that overestimate. And people are beginning to look around for other frames of references, other sources of meaning, other kinds of values that give their lives some shape. And consequently, this rather remarkable reappropriation, you might say, of traditional religious beliefs and practices, which just was not anticipated 25 years ago.
And which
by
curious,
hardly anyone.
Which has curiously led to increasing conflict between fundamentalists and religious groups, between Muslim and Christians, between Jews and Christians.
Yeah, it's paradoxical in a way. On the one hand, we have more harmony and dialogue going on among religious groups who were more antagonistic in some ways 25 years ago. For example, the relationship between Catholics and Protestants at some levels, or the relationship between Christians and Jews, which is, I think, improved to a great extent, and one could name other kinds of areas of more harmonious interaction. And at the same time, we have deepened conflict in other places, sometimes among the same groups or other groups, and internal conflicts within the various religious groups between, on the one hand, those who want to be more open and more pluralistic, and those who are moving toward a more fundamentalist and narrower construction of what their traditions mean. It's a very, very mixed and confused picture, but I think it's made more volatile by the fact that religion is playing a more singular and more important role in the public area. That's where the conflicts go on. If it were contained within the private area of personal and family life, there wouldn't be as much conflict. But when it begins to get into the public area, as it has, then the conflict becomes more evident.
One of the areas that's interested you is that of liberation theology, in particular what's going on in Latin America, how, for instance, the Catholic Church is being involved in political change there. How did you become interested in that dynamic?
Well, many years ago, I wrote a little book that hardly anyone has ever heard of called God's Revolution and Human Responsibility. And the book was translated into Spanish. Many of my books have been translated into various languages, but that one was translated and was read by some Latin Americans who invited me to visit Latin America. This is now some 20 years ago. And I did. At that time, I didn't know any Spanish. I knew very little about the Latin American continent. And I immediately became very, very attracted, even kind of inspired by what I saw going on there, which was, in effect, a transformation of what had been a very traditional, even kind of feudal, Catholic church into a church which was much more committed to the poor, marginated peoples, to the oppressed and outcast parts of the society, something which also had not been anticipated 25 years ago. It almost proved to me that a whole church can undergo what is something very close to a conversion. So I went back a couple years later and spent the summer learning Spanish and traveled around a good deal and have continued to be in touch. In fact, this has become one of the major areas of my research. I now teach courses here at Harvard on Latin American theology, on liberation theology, and I keep rather closely in touch with it. It has also become one of the most important segments of the worldwide Catholic Church, certainly one of the most creative, both spiritually and intellectually.
But also one of the most controversial within the church.
And one of the most controversial, that's true.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. In your biography, you were talking about the Baptist Church, which is the church in which you were raised, and in particular about the Black Baptist Church at one point, saying that the preaching can become bombastic or overly bent on arousing effects. Still, what is vital about Black worship is that people in the pews bring their entire range of hopes and resentments into the sanctuary, not just some religious segment. And it seems that there you're seeing the kind of power and combination of religion and day-to-day life that's, for instance, enabled preachers such as Jesse Jackson to come into such political power here in this country.
Yeah, that's exactly... That's exactly right, and the Black churches in the United States, even back before there was a United States, when there were Black churches in the period before American independence, the Black churches have never separated out the religious and the spiritual from the other parts of life the way more establishment-oriented churches have. Its life has always been seen as of a piece with religion permeating everything else. So it's not seen as unnatural within a Black church, a Black Baptist or Methodist church, for example, for there to be worship and praise and sermons and prayers and also discussions about local or even larger political and social concerns that are impinging on the life of the congregation. And I think that's a very healthy, holistic view of life. It's something that all of us have something to learn from, those of us who are not part of that tradition. It's something that the Catholic bishops here in the United States have also picked up on in a way. You remember in the last 5 or 6 years, they have begun issuing pastoral letters about things like nuclear weapons or unemployment and the state of the economy and things
and poverty
like this.
And so on.
Yes, and a lot of people said, well, what are they talking about that kind of stuff for? What does this have to do with religion? When anybody who knows the first thing about the Bible realizes that the Bible itself is about these issues. It's about homelessness and work and disease and conflict and peacemaking and all the rest. So I think they're guiding their churches in a way toward a more holistic view as well. And I see this happening in many different religious traditions. This isn't restricted also only to Christian churches.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. Many of us are aware of Islam and of the practicing Muslims of the world through what has been going on in the Middle East and in Iran. And I think many in this country have a sense of Islam as being a particularly pernicious religion, one that is interested in fomenting violence in the world. Yet in your book, Many Mansions, you talk about a young woman who came to you to apply to be a teaching assistant in your Jesus and Morality class. And she turned out to be Muslim, and that sort of threw you into a quandary. What was the quandary for you?
Well, I remember the day very well. She was a graduate student in comparative religion who had excellent credentials, both in her scholarly work and in her teaching competence. And I just wondered what my students would think if they walked into a discussion section, which I was interviewing people to lead, and found that a Muslim was leading a discussion section on the Gospels. And so it gave me pause for a moment. And then, as you'll notice in the book, I went on to have a very, very important conversation with her in which she taught me something I suppose I should have known, which is that in the Muslim tradition, Jesus is honored and respected, whereas the history of Christianity does not assign the same kind of place of respect to the Prophet Muhammad. And she pointed out several, even of the Christian classics, like, for example, a whole section in Dante's Inferno, which really paints a terribly negative picture of the Prophet Muhammad. I learned a lot from her. As it turned out, she was not able to stay and be a teaching assistant. I wish she had. She had to return to her country. But it opened for me a door into an adventure in learning about the history of Islam, which raised a lot of questions about the present image that many people have in their mind of Islam as this rather nasty and violence-prone religion. People who don't know about whole other aspects of Islam and about the gentle, reciprocal, and dialogical side, about the whole Islamic civilization, which was there in the medieval period when our civilization was still quasi-barbaric, and who have to realize that in the long view of things, a lot of the negative side of Islam that we see now is in response to a considerable period of Western Christian dominance of Islamic countries. Islam has become, for many of them, the voice of their own past and of their own dignity, of their own identity and history against what they see as Western domination. And in the midst of all this, I don't think we should fail to see that Islam is now becoming one of the major religious traditions of the United States. It is no longer a simply foreign tradition. In fact, sometime during this past couple years, the number of Muslims in the United States moved slightly passed the number of Jews in the United States, so that it is now the it is a religious minority, but a growing one.
Is this mostly through immigration?
Almost entirely through immigration. Mm-hmm. There are some conversions, but almost entirely through immigration from Muslim countries. And the Muslims who come here are almost always enormously interested in having dialogue and deepening understanding between themselves and their Christian neighbors. And in many places in the country, there have been very productive meetings and conversations that have been sponsored by local mosques and local churches. And my hope is that the experience of religious pluralism, of mutual respect, which these Muslims, who are now our fellow citizens, many of them increasingly, the experience they have here of a country where religious pluralism works to everyone's advantage, will influence the countries in which Islam is a 95% majority, let's say, like in Saudi Arabia or in Iran or in Iraq, to modify their attitudes toward religious minorities in their countries. I think it's a long road and a very big picture, but I'm hopeful.
Well, unfortunately, part of the tradition also is of people who bring a religion with them is sometimes the battles and disputes come with them as well to a new land. Whether
yeah,
it's
that often happens too.
Muslim or Sikh or Catholic and Protestant. Whatever. There was a time, I think it was in 12th century Spain, about the time of Sabio the Wise, when Christians, Jews, and Muslims were all working and living together. There was a tremendous blooming of art and of music and of a culture at ease with itself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this as perhaps sort of a re-renaissance that we may have sometime in the future, the future of religion?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that period in Spanish history, because I like to study it, and I even went over to Spain a few years ago to familiarize myself with it a little more. Here was this period, just at and before the Christian, what we call the Middle Ages, or the medieval period, in which Christians and Jews and Muslims all lived together in what is now Spain and Portugal, with some tensions among them, but by and large in mutual respect, helping each other in the construction of their mosques and synagogues and cathedrals, borrowing from each other's poetry, being influenced by each other's spirituality. For example, we now know that St. John of the Cross was considerably influenced by Sufi mysticism, which is a branch of a form of Islamic mysticism. Now, what happened, unfortunately, is that the Jews were expelled from Spain, and the Muslims were defeated militarily and also expelled, those who were left. And a form of Christianity became the kind of ideology for uniting the Hispanic peninsula, and therefore it became intolerant and punishing. That golden era was lost.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that it was there, I think, provides us with a wonderful example of how it could happen again in the future.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. He's a professor at the Harvard Divinity School and the author of 8 books, including The Secular City, Turning East, and Feast of Fools. His new book, Many Mansions, tells of his experiences establishing dialogues with people of many different faiths. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. His new book is called Many Mansions, and the quotation comes from John. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. You see this as the means of saying that there can be many religions and that we can all live in this plurality. Yet further on in that book of John, There's also a line that refers to Jesus being the only way. How are you able to reconcile these in your mind? Certainly one is used by fundamentalist Christians, the other by say, yourself.
Yeah, and isn't it intriguing that both of those verses are found within five or six lines of each other in the same chapter of the same gospel? In fact, this is what motivated me to investigate this whole theme and to write this book, Many Mansions. In Christianity, as in many traditions, many religious traditions, and the Christian tradition is my own, so I can speak of it more, I suppose, more honestly, there is both an inclusivist and universalist dimension and a narrower and more provincial or more, exclusivist dimension. And these are always in tension with each other. Every religious tradition has its own set of central events and memories, a sacred text. But the great world traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have a vision of the whole, which is not unrelated to this central core of its own. So it's holding these in the kind of dynamic and fruitful tension that I think is what we're called upon to do.
Uh-huh.
Well, what I'm saying in this book is that tolerance is certainly not enough. Tolerance is a kind of a lackadaisical, lazy man's way of looking at this. I'm interested in a far more active interaction and vigorous, robust interaction among religious traditions, rather than just sort of a live and let live attitude.
For instance, your interest in Krishna has appreciated the shown you the feminine aspects of God.
Yes, right. I think each of these traditions has something to learn from one or more of the others, but only if we are completely honest, if we don't kind of dodge the hard and difficult issues that we have to that are there. And I think what I try to do in this book also is to talk about those parts of my experience of dialogue with people from other religions where the going has been very rough, where I've discovered things I really didn't like, and they have discovered things about our tradition that they didn't like. I think facing those kinds of rough edges is a part of real dialogue rather than a kind of a patsy or wimpy way of doing it. So that's all the case that I'm trying to make in this book, and I'm trying to make it very personal. It's not a book about the abstract comparison of Buddhism with Christianity. There are a lot of books like that. This is talking from a very personal point of view what my experiences have been as I've tried to engage people in these other traditions in very basic kinds of conversation.
A few years ago, you took the telephone out of your house because you found it intrusive. Do you still have your telephone out?
That was a long time ago, Sedge. Uh-huh. That was about 20 years ago when before my children reached teenage.
Uh-huh.
By the time they approached their teenage years, the thought of not having a telephone in the house was like moving to the North Pole and living in an igloo. So I lost that one. But for a few years, we didn't have a telephone. That's right.
You've talked about the importance of the nuclear family, but in many ways, I think now we have the extended family around us. And I think you're a prime example of that. You're now in your 50s and have a second family in many ways going now.
Yeah, that's right. I have a little. I'm approaching my 60s. I'll be 60 during this calendar year, and I have a 2.5-year-old boy, who's a great delight and the source of my ever renewed youth. Although he tires me out.
You're raised Baptist. Your wife is Jewish. I understand you're raising your son to be Jewish. Is this an easy choice for you? How are you handling this in your family?
No choices are entirely easy. The Jewish law is very specific on this, that a child born of a Jewish mother is Jewish, no matter what happens to him or what he decides to do or be. And I think as the husband and father in such a family, I have a responsibility for making him familiar with that tradition. And so we observe Sabbath at our house. We observe the Jewish holidays. we also observe the Christian holidays as well. And we are trying the way we define it is we are raising this child to be Jewish, to be and to understand his Jewishness as a unique way of being Jewish, because he's the son of a Christian father, and that makes a difference in the way he interprets and constructs his own faith. Now, we do this day by day and week by week, and it's not an easy choice, but we're now part of a network, a very, very large network, I might say, of parents of mixed marriages, Jewish-Christian marriages, characterized by the common choice that all of these couples have made not to give up their individual traditions. This is the way it used to be done, you know. One would give up on it, often both of them would give up, because the idea of trying to combine these in any way seemed insurmountably difficult. But there are, we think now, hundreds and hundreds of couples who have come to the conclusion that they want to raise their children in what might be called religious dual citizenship, if possible, and who are helping each other, exchanging materials and talking back and forth. And we don't do it with any cocksureness that we know all the answers. We're taking it day by day, but so far things are going very well.
One other question. You went to divinity school, and so I assume some point before that in your life there must have been an experience, a religious experience, a spiritual experience of some kind that told you to follow that route. Was there one particular moment, or was it just something you always felt?
You know, I'm always embarrassed to say this, but I cannot remember a time from my childhood on when I wasn't very, very clear that I wanted to be a minister. I still consider myself to be a minister. I teach in a school in which a large part of what we do is prepare people for ministry in the various churches. So I never underwent one of those classical kind of conversion crises, or a voice calling to me in the night or something. I just grew up believing that this was what I was supposed to be, and very, very happy about it, and very glad to respond to it. And it's been something about which I've never had any second thoughts. So I'm sorry to disabuse you of any notions that there was some great calling moment. I know a lot of people have had those, but I just never did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today on Fresh Air about these issues.
Well, thanks for having me.
Harvey Cox's new book is titled Many Mansions. It's published by Beacon Press. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with San Francisco longshoreman, poet and novelist George Benet. His new book is A Short Dance in the Sun. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation this week. I'm in from San Francisco for her. Eva Hoffman came to North America as a teenager from her native Poland. She was a linguistically lost newcomer, but is now a noted intellectual critic and editor, a journey she chronicles in her new memoir, Lost in Translation, A Life in a New Language. Coming up, we meet Eva Hoffman. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings from Lloyd's favorite orchestra, the Cleveland. And what is a Hoosier? Who's a Hoosier, anyway? Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg knows, and he explains the term to us. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Democratic-controlled Senate today gave unanimous approval to James Baker to become Secretary of State. Baker's former deputy at the Treasury Department, Richard Darman, was also confirmed to become Budget Director. And in a final 99-0 vote, former Secretary of Transportation Elizabeth Dole was confirmed as Secretary of Labor. Baker, Darman, and Dole were the first Bush appointees to face Senate confirmation. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh, Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, and Education Secretary Lauro Cavazos are holdovers from the Reagan administration and do not require confirmation to continue to serve. The president confirmed today that the Treasury Department is considering as one option a fee on deposits to savings and loans. The fees would be paid by the depositors, but White House officials insisted the fee is not a new tax. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
President Bush told two reporters in an interview today that the idea of a fee on deposits is an option, but that it has not been formally recommended to him. And the president denied this qualifies as a new tax. He compared it to an entrance fee for Yosemite National Park. White House Chief of Staff John Sununu told reporters the fee is one of many options and that the others will be publicly discussed in the coming days. He insisted it is not a new tax, but rather a fee for the federal insurance on deposits. He argued that it was merely an extension of the fee the savings institutions now pay for the same insurance, but this would be the first time such a fee were charged to depositors. The idea was originally contained in the last Reagan budget and was recently discussed with members of Congress who reportedly gave it a cold reception. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today, "What you're looking at is a trial balloon. We're willing to discuss it and see how it flies." And he indicated there will be other trial balloons in the near future. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Michigan Democratic leader Richard Wiener said today he's dropping out of the race for Democratic national chairman. The announcement practically assures that Ronald Brown will become the party's first black chairman. Wiener today endorsed Brown, who managed the Reverend Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign. The election for a new party chairman to succeed Paul Kirk is scheduled for February 10th. The spirit of bipartisanship invoked by George Bush at his inaugural was extended today on Capitol Hill. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports on the agenda set out today by the leaders of both parties in the Senate.
The Democratic leader of the Senate, Maine's George Mitchell, today responded to President Bush's extended hand by offering his own, saying that Democrats would work with the White House and the Republicans in the Senate in forging a bipartisan foreign policy and putting aside the battles of the past. In his maiden address as majority leader, Mitchell put forward an unusual sort of state of the party message as he talked about the relationship of citizens and their government, echoing several times John Kennedy's challenge to ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Mitchell's Republican counterpart, Kansas Senator Robert Dole, reminded his colleagues of just how little the country can do about a host of issues both men agreed needed addressing. In talking about the federal deficit, Dole emphasized that someone will have to pick up the tab for programs like daycare, long-term health care, drug enforcement and education, and help for the homeless. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The White House says President Bush has decided that the head of the federal anti-drug effort will not be a member of the cabinet. William Bennett will enjoy cabinet rank, but will not formally be included at the cabinet table. The president already has cut two other positions from his cabinet, that of CIA director and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 8 points to close at 2264.29. Advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 184 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Baseball fans know that the success or failure of a team depends upon the skill of its manager. The eminence of an orchestra is sometimes assessed in a sporting metaphor, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the Cleveland Orchestra is at the top of the league standings again because the right man is swinging the baton at home podium.
For over a decade after the death of conductor George Zell, the Cleveland Orchestra fell on dark days. But when Christoph von Dohnányi took over its musical direction six seasons ago, he immediately began to restore Cleveland to its preeminent position among American orchestras. Of course, it's pointless to play the game of ranking orchestras, but I know that right now the Cleveland is the one I'd go furthest out of my way to hear. You can hear why on two of their recent recordings. One is an album on Telarc that couples Mendelssohn's last and best symphony, The Scottish, with his seldom heard but thematically related dramatic cantata, Die Erste Walpurgisnacht. The other, on London, includes Schumann's first and second symphonies. The clarity and elegance of the playing, the balanced textures, the right-on-target tempo decisions, the dancing lilt and lift are instantly audible. So many conductors choose perfectly acceptable tempos, then cram the music into rhythmic straitjackets. But the unforced rhythmic flow of Dohnányi's phrasing lets the music breathe at every speed. He's not a conductor who imposes a quirky or even particularly personal stamp on what he plays, but his key opens the door to a mansion where style and content live in perfect harmony. The surprise among these discs is Die Erste Walpurgisnacht, Mendelssohn's setting of Goethe's revisionist ballad about how the Druids were so oppressed by the early Christians, they had to scare them off with devil masks in order to continue practicing their pure and sincere nature worship. Walpurgisnacht is April 30th, May Day Eve, usually thought of as a kind of witch's Sabbath. Mendelssohn worked on this cantata over a period of 13 years. It's one of his least performed but most attractive scores. The recording, with four outstanding vocal soloists, makes the work itself seem like a fresh new addition to the repertory. Here's Finnish baritone Tom Krause as the Druid high priest arming his guards with stakes and pitchforks, flames and rattling sticks, to scare diesen dumpfen Pfaffenchristen, these dim-witted Christians.
Kommt, kommt, kommt mit Hacken und mit Garten und mit Hut und Knapperstöcken, denn wie ein echter Ballon durch den engen Felsen strecken. Kommt, 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 kommt mit Hacken und mit Garten und mit Hut und Knapperstöcken, denn wie ein echter Ballon. Kommt, 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 mit Hacken und mit Sacken und mit Knappen, Knappenstücken, 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 Knappen und in Händen, Felsenstücken.
The Schumann symphonies were always a staple of the Cleveland Orchestra under Zell, but I never found much heart in their old recordings. Dohnányi, however, makes the orchestra sing with romantic longing and leap with nervous fire. With both Telarc and London offering superior digital sound, and the performances so sympathetic, these discs have a rare distinction among new recordings, the highest tech combined with the most genuine, old-fashioned understanding.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and is director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed two new recordings of the Cleveland Orchestra playing Mendelssohn and Schubert on the Telarc and London record labels. This is Fresh Air. When Eva Hoffman was 13, her family moved to Canada from Poland. The struggles we all face during early adolescence were only heightened for Hoffman by the extreme change in her environment. She couldn't find the words to describe all the new things around her, the houses, clothes, trees, birds, or to express her feelings in the language she would eventually make her own. Hoffman went on to study English literature at Rice and Harvard Universities. She settled in New York, where she is now an editor at the New York Times Book Review. Hoffman recounts her cultural metamorphosis in her memoir, Lost in Translation, A Life in a New Language. I asked her what she remembers as the most difficult adjustment she had to make.
It wasn't that, you know, some one thing in my world had changed. Everything had changed. So that, you know, the world seemed alien and incomprehensible in its most fundamental details. I remember early on walking down an ordinary suburban street with my sister and looking at the houses in that street and trying to figure out in Polish, of course, we didn't know any English at that point, trying to figure out, well, what would you call these houses? And we would say villa. I mean, that's sort of a word that you use in Polish for a certain, for a townhouse. No, it wasn't quite that. Is it like a house in a village? No, it isn't quite that. Well, what is this? You know, we had never seen architecture like that, and we had never seen suburbia. You know, we didn't have a notion of this place between the city and the country. And for me, I mean, that was the most acute loss, you know, was not to have language, words which would make the world, you know, familiar and cozy and my own.
You talk about a word, the Polish word, and I may be mispronouncing this, tęsknota.
Yes.
Which is like a form of nostalgia. Now, nostalgia means a pain of remembering. Mm-hmm. Does this word have a similar context to in Polish?
Yes, it does. It has that context with, I think, a sort of added element of great yearning, of missing the place and a yearning to be there. It's as much about the present as about the past. I mean, it has a sense of being drawn back to the place which you have left.
This seems to be sort of a theme of your reaction to moving to this country, sort of a moving forward while also trying to retain the past, a sense of trying to remember how boys and girls were in Poland with how they are in the new land, and trying mm-hmm. to combine them in some way that's intelligible.
You know, I mean, adolescent immigration is probably, you know, the most tricky, because you are just beginning to form yourself, you know, and to have a sense of who you are, but you aren't completely formed yet. And I was formed enough so that I felt a sort of loyalty, you know, to my past, to my former identity. And it was what I, you know, what I had, what I knew.
At what point do you feel you passed through the membrane of being an outsider to become a participant in the culture? Do you remember that transition?
I think it was quite gradual. I think, I mean, probably one salient moment was, in fact, going to Europe and seeing that, you know, seeing how much I've become Americanized. I mean, that I was, you know, not European. You know, that my movements, my gestures, my points of reference, you know, had become quite permeated.
Language can be both a means of misdirection or of holding someone off, but it's also the means of expressing intimate thoughts to one another. You have a section in your book that I think speaks very clearly about the difficulties and how you tended to adjust toward the English language. And I wonder if you might read this to us.
Okay.
It's the one on page 245.
All right. "I love you," I murmured to the man beside me in the nearly inaudible voice in which these most private utterances are made. "These words are meant only for my lover. They are said in that space in which there is almost no space between us, in which they're almost the palpable filament of breath." For a long time, it was difficult to speak these most intimate phrases, hard to make English, the language of woolen abstraction, shape itself into the tonalities of love. In Polish, the words for boy and girl embodied within them the wind and crackle of boyishness, the breeze and grace of girlhood. The words summoned that evanescent movement and melody and mask that are the interior inflections of gender itself. In English, men and women were empty signs. Terms of endearment came out as formal and foursquare as other words. In that neutral and neutered speech, words were neither masculine nor feminine. They did not arise out of erotic substance, out of sex. How could I say darling or sweetheart when the words had no fleshly fullness, when they were as dry as sticks? But now the language has entered my body, has incorporated itself in the softest tissue of my being. Darling, I say to my lover, my dear, and the words are filled and brimming with the motions of my desire. They curve themselves within my mouth to the complex music of tenderness. Perhaps you cannot love one person when you don't love the world surrounding him, the common sensibility that somehow expresses itself in each one of us. It has taken me a while to recognize sexuality in the American grain, to see what is to be trusted within it. I can read the lineaments of decency and a sort of ardent honesty in the face of this man beside me. I trust the will that drives him hard to make sense of things without games or camouflage, that modest American forthrightness that is the best part of innocence. His passion flows from that honesty, and it propels me to speak with that ease in which everything can be said. We speak, my lover and I, until words tumble out without obstacle, until they deliquesce into pure flow, until they become the air we breathe, until they merge with our flesh.
That's a very beautiful passage.
Thank you.
And the language there flows to you, and it does not come across as abstract as you see English as a language being. It sounds very vivid and felt.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I mean, I think that that was a long evolution to get to that point, but it was what I wanted language to be. I mean, I wanted it to be a part of myself. I mean, that learning language abstractly was really not very hard. What took very long was for the language to, you know, permeate into the cells of, you know, the cells of my being.
This book of yours, Lost in Translation, was it for you kind of a passage in writing it?
It turned out to be. You know, I didn't set out to do it for therapeutic reasons or because I thought it would be cathartic or anything like that. I set out to do it because I thought, you know, that the certain aspect of the immigrant experience has really not been written about with exactitude. And it was precisely this aspect of translating yourself, of translating your identity into a new culture and a new language. But I have now told the story, and it is there, and I no longer have to sort of preserve it and be very so preoccupied with it as I was. And also, you know, the responses to the book have been wonderful and generous, and I see that people understand.
Would you like to see it translated into Polish?
Yes, that might be very interesting, and I think, you know, it's not unlikely that it will be. And, you know, that would be very gratifying, I mean, to just have that circular return.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Eva Hoffman's memoir, Lost in Translation, A Life in a New Language, is published by Dutton. She's an editor for the New York Times Book Review. This is Fresh Air. In a while, we're going to National Public Radio for today's news on All Things Considered. Host Robert Siegel has joined me to give us a report on what we can expect to hear. I understand insurance rates of a kind are going up.
Well, they might, Sedge. The rates, who's to pay for federal deposit insurance? One of the schemes being talked about to address the savings and loan crisis, the thrift institution crisis, is to charge depositors for their federal insurance at the rate of about 0.25% of their deposits. The Treasury Department has been thinking about it. I mentioned it on Capitol Hill yesterday, where, to put it mildly, it did not go over well. We'll hear about that, and also about Labor Department investigators in New York City who cracked down on violators of the child labor laws.
That's all coming up on All Things Considered in a while here on National Public Radio. Who's a Hoosier? What's a Hoosier? Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg answers these questions about regional nicknames.
The great Hoosier hubbub began in March of 1987 when New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato predicted on the Senate floor that his alma mater Syracuse would beat the Indiana Hoosiers handily in the NCAA basketball finals the following day. He went on to make fun of the Indiana team, noting that Merriam-Webster's Third International Dictionary defined Hoosier not only as a native of Indiana, but as an ignorant rustic. But the Hoosiers squeaked out the game by 1 point, sparked by Steve Alford's outside shooting. And the next day, Indiana's junior senator Dan Quayle took the floor to congratulate the team and to propose that the Senate adopt a non-binding resolution that would redefine the word Hoosier. Be it resolved that a Hoosier is someone who is smart, resourceful, skillful, a winner, and brilliant. All of this was just routine senatorial hijinks, but Quayle was apparently in earnest. According to a recent story in the Washington Post, Quayle wrote to William Llewellyn, the president of the Merriam-Webster Company, and asked that the offending definition of Hoosier be removed and that his own definition be substituted in its place. Llewellyn explained that dictionaries were in the business of reporting the way that words are actually used, but that if Quayle could persuade the rest of America to take up the new use of the word, Merriam-Webster would be delighted to include it in the next edition. When last heard from, Quayle's office was threatening to ban Webster's Third from its bookshelves. As it happens, Midwesterners have been using the word Hoosier as a pejorative since the 19th century. According to St. Louis Post-Dispatch columnist Elaine Vietz, in Missouri, a Hoosier is a low-life redneck, somebody you can recognize because, as she puts it, they have a car on concrete blocks in their front yard and are likely to have just shot their wife, who may also be their sister. Actually, nobody's sure where Hoosier comes from, but the best guess is that it's derived from the British dialect word hooser, meaning big or large. As early as 1832, the word was used in America to refer to a big rustic, a galoot. Probably it was this meaning that led to the use of the word to refer to Indianans rather than the other way around. In the 19th century, there seems to have been a disparaging nickname for the inhabitants of just about every state. There were Texas beatheads, Alabama lizards, Nebraska bug eaters, South Carolina weasels, and Pennsylvania leatherheads. If it's any consolation to Vice President Quayle, in fact, he could point out to Miss Vietz that folks from Missouri used to be known by the endearing name of pukes. Originally, these names may have been applied by the inhabitants of neighboring states, but most of them were adopted by the natives in a spirit of contrary frontier humor. You bet I'm a bug eater's son and proud of it. Nowadays, only a few of these nicknames survive, usually for the sports teams of state universities, the Tar Heels, the Buckeyes, and so on. But they're not fighting words anymore. Apart from Hoosier, only Okie and Georgia Crackers still have any negative connotations. The rest of the nicknames seem to have fallen victim to fastidiousness or to Chamber of Commerce boosterism. When you're touting the superior educational levels of the local citizens to get a corporate headquarters or a super collider for your state, you're probably not going to refer to them as beatheads. Then, too, the homogenized culture of modern America has tended to smooth out all these regional identities. People still come out to root for Old State U, but we've come a long way since the days when Thomas Jefferson could refer to Virginia as my country. Come to think of it, maybe the Merriam-Webster people should change the meaning of Hoosier, not in Quayle's way, but to something more realistic. Hoosier, a person who eats fast food, goes jogging, and watches 30-something on TV. And, okay, just to be fair, they could add, and who's particularly dangerous from outside the three-point line.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a California linguist, and as far as I know, not a Hoosier, associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. The British have long had an ambivalent attitude about their class system, denying its existence on the one hand and then basking in its trappings on the other. On the next Fresh Air, British writer and director Mike Lee explains his fascination with social class and how he depicts it in his latest film, High Hopes. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Mystery Girl, Roy Orbison's posthumous album. And film critic Stephen Schiff examines Physical Evidence, a new thriller starring Teresa Russell, Burt Reynolds, and Ned Beatty. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.